Welcome once again, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. I am John Manuel, joined today by Jim Callis, live via the magic of the interwebs and G-Chat. So, Jim, welcome into the podcast, and hope everybody enjoys this podcast. Obviously, a big project for us this week, Draft Report Cards. And I say this week, really the last couple weeks, Jim, I would say that Draft Report Cards consumed my life.
Yeah, they did for me, too. You know, I actually took the weekend off. I came down to beautiful Durham, North Carolina.
You
in the
did.
Middle of the draft report card issue, only because I got started on the project early, and it was still tough catching up. But I think it's amazing how much information we cram into 6 or 7 point type or whatever it is that we run in the magazine. And, you know, we probably could write at least 50% more on most teams' draft report cards if given the space. We cram an awful lot of information into I guess it's 5 pages of team-by-team breakdowns and another page for an overview. But it's a labor of love, and I do think they're great. You know, it kind of kicks off our off-season prospect coverage. It gets us going for the team top 10s and top 30s that we do in the issue in the prospect handbook, and it brings up guys you need to know from that standpoint. And I think it's also good to kind of, you know, we cover, obviously, the draft so much. Before the draft, you know, reacting, you know, who gets picked where, then the signing deadline. And it's kind of like a last, you know, detailed look back at the draft. Well, you know, how these guys really do in their first pro summer.
Right. I also like, Jim, that for you and for me, you know, it's really hard to follow all 30 organizations. But it really seems like this really does lay the groundwork for us to help edit and shape a lot of the organization top 30s. You really feel like, and I also like that you and I alternate National League and American League, because I really feel like it gives me a base to talk intelligently to every writer about their organization top 30s. I feel like I can do that anyway, but having talked to the scouting directors of all 30 organizations basically the last 2 years in depth, you know, at least a 30-minute conversation, if not longer, I really feel like that gives me a base, and I can always go back to those guys if I have questions when we're editing top 30s. That's one of the things I like best about doing draft report cards. It really... It's fun to write draft report cards, but it has multiple benefits going forward, both from compiling our College All-America team, editing top 30s, coming off of league top 20s. It's just great to get that, to sit down, have this conversation, and get that feedback with guys in the industry. For me, it's an invaluable exercise.
It's one of my favorite things to do. I mean, this will probably bring a chuckle out of you, but I mean, you know, for years I tried to do all 30 of them, and I didn't want to give up doing all 30 of them, and it just became too time-consuming, because I think if you go from start to finish, you know, from doing a little prep before you talk to a scouting director, to talking to the scouting director, to writing these up, I mean, it's probably a good, I don't know, probably close to 2 hours per team by the time you're done.
And, no doubt.
You know, obviously 2 hours time per team times 30 teams is 60 hours. It's a very long time there. But, no, I enjoy it, too, and for exactly the reasons you said. I enjoy talking to the scouting directors. They enjoy talking about this stuff, and I just think it really gives you a base of knowledge. Because, I mean, for, you know, a typical team, I mean, you may not talk over each guy in depth, but, I mean, you're discussing at least 15, 20 players out of each team's draft. And, you know, even the guys you don't sign, I always think that's one of the more interesting things is, you know, it's not always, you know, in many cases it's not the top unsigned pick who's the best player they didn't sign. But, you know, getting a sense, like, you know, especially a team like, you know, say the Red Sox, who take a bunch of chances on guys who are tough to sign, you who do they think the best guy is, or, you know, learning about guys, and then, you know, 3 years down the road they're a good draft pick, and before that they're a good college player. So it's one of my favorite projects. I just wish it wasn't so time consuming, but maybe I guess that's why we get so much out of it, is because we put so much time into it.
It really is. I really don't know how you did all 30 in those years. It's kind of startling. Let's get into discussing some of them. And I think the thing that most people, our readers, really, and let's face it, people like lists. We rank a lot of things, Jim. We rank the top 5 best drafts in this draft class. So let's talk a little bit about those drafts. And I think we had a pretty decent consensus between the two of us. You know, I think every year the teams that have the best drafts, frequently those teams in the top 5 are going to be the teams that had extra picks. Now, I don't recall if we ranked the Phillies draft last year in the top 5. I remember I liked their draft better than you did last year. And a year out, I still like that draft for Philadelphia. You know, best draft this year was the Rockies, which had a couple of extra picks, but I wouldn't necessarily classify it as a bonanza of picks. It's not like they had 5 of the first 50 or something like that. They did have 3 early. But what set the Rockies draft apart for you after talking to Bill Schmidt especially?
Well, I think what set it apart was you and I even identified this minutes after it happened on draft day back in June. They did have two extra picks. They had an extra first rounder and a sandwich pick. But I think what jumped out for me with them is they got just tremendous, tremendous values with each of those top three picks. They got guys who had no business being there for their pick based on how talented the players were. I mean, with their first pick at number 11, they got Tyler Matzik, and we discussed, before the draft, it was unclear where he was going to go. He was making noise about wanting unprecedented money. He finished real strong, high school lefty from California. A lot of teams, not a lot of teams, but some teams had him ranked as the second best player in the entire draft after Strasburg.
Yeah, he definitely finished really, really strong, too.
I mean, he was a legit, top of the first round, top half of the first round guy who then was great, throwing 97, 98 with a great breaking ball down the stretch. What I loved about that pick, and we discussed this at the time too, with the Rockies is we can or cannot get into a discussion about why the draft works, doesn't work, but the teams, as much of complaining as people do about how the draft doesn't work the way it's supposed to work, I'm getting to the point where I blame the teams almost as much as anybody.
Agreed.
I'm not saying you should take guys and not sign them to make a point, but a lot of these guys are going to sign. A lot of these guys want to sign, and they may throw out a big number or say, don't draft me, I'm not signing for that. And in the end, they're going to sign on the sign deadline because they either don't want to go to college or they don't want to, especially if you're a college junior, they don't want to go back for your senior year. So anyway, with Matzik, here's a guy who everybody thought, okay, unprecedented money means he wants more than the $7 million that Rick Porcello and Josh Beckett got out of college. And the Rockies aren't a big revenue team, but they were smart about this. They had two extra picks coming up at 32 and 34, so if they don't sign Matzik, it doesn't blow their draft, and instead of negotiating all summer, or even really, I don't think the negotiations on Matzik really lasted more than a day or two. They just took it all the way to the end because they knew it was going to come to the end because you can't sign a guy for well over slide before the deadline anyway. And they offered him, they got him done for $3.9 million. And I would have definitely taken the over on that. I really would have thought Matzik would have gotten at least $5 million. So the Rockies got a great value, and they took the best guy on the board, which enough teams don't do. They got a tremendous value by doing so, and they didn't pay nearly as much as people thought would take to sign him. And then after that, they came back with the last pick in the first round. They got Tim Wheeler, who we had ranked as a mid-first-round pick, and I think is underrated. I think he's a guy who proved himself in the Cape League, came out, had a great junior year.
Has some athletic ability.
I don't think there's a huge difference between him and, say, A.J. Pollock, who went 17th to the Diamondbacks.
Correct.
A.J. might be a slightly better athlete and a slightly better chance to stay in center field, but I think Wheeler's underrated in pretty much every aspect of the game. I thought that was a great pick at 32. And then two picks after that with the compensation pick at 34, they got Rex Brothers, who's one of the best lefties in the draft, college lefty. They're going to pitch him out of the bullpen. He's going to move really quick.
Yep.
And Rex Brothers was a guy we thought had a chance to go as high as 15th in the draft. We had him ranked as a mid-first-round pick. And you had kind of a tumbling domino effect where four of the first eight picks were taken because of signability over ability. What that did is that dropped Alex White of North Carolina out of the upper part of the first round and dropped him to the Indians at 15. When he went to the Indians at 15, that's where guys like Eric Arnett and Rex Brothers were supposed to go. And then they kind of got, instead of going in front of this big group of athletic outfielders, they went behind them. So I really thought the Rockies got three of the top, say, 16 or 18 players in the draft with picks 11, 32, and 34. And they said that they're also very excited about a guy named Nolan Arenado, high school third baseman from California. They think he's an even better pure hitter than Tim Wheeler and some of those other guys. So they had a very good draft, and they went on and got some college hitters after that, and Ben Paulson and Kent Mathis. But I just liked everything about that draft. I mean, you get great values at the top, and then you keep hitting on guys after that.
I think notable here for the Rockies is that Matzik, you wouldn't expect them to step out on Matzik. They're not necessarily an overslot club, not too frequently anyway. And then, but Matzik, in their early years of the Rockies, they drafted heavily for high school pitching in the first round. Jamie Wright in 93, Doug Millian in 94, Jake Westbrook 96, Mark Mangum 97, Matt Roney 98. Those are four of their first seven or eight first round picks that they drafted were high school pitchers. They hadn't drafted a high school pitcher in the first round since 1998. There was a supplemental that they signed.
Don't forget
in 2000, I was about to say, in 2000, I threw in that they signed. In 2000, they had that experience with Matt Harrington, the worst draft holdout of them all, where it was bad for them and worse for Matt Harrington. And that obviously did not work out. And I don't know if they were stung by that. That was Bill Schmidt's first draft as scouting director, if I'm not mistaken. And they have never drafted a high school pitcher in the first round since then. They had a supplemental pick in Chaz Rowe, and he hasn't necessarily worked out. But they stepped out of their box a little bit, and I think it really helped. I'm thinking of the Indians as another organization, Jim, that I think has a very strong philosophy of how they like to draft. And in my opinion, it's a little conservative. I respect those guys, but I think they usually they err on the side of the college bat, and it hasn't always worked out for them. You know, Trevor Crowe is an example. I know people were on Trevor Crowe. I think you recall I was never on Trevor Crowe. Never understood why Trevor Crowe was the big guy to take. People wanted to falling all over themselves to take him in 2005. I was much more on the Ellsbury train back then, and anyway, that's one I got right. There are lots I got wrong. Feel free to send those into us at podcast@baseballamerica.com. But, you know, last year in 2008, I felt like the Indians stepped out of their box a little bit with a guy in Lonnie Chisenhall. And I think Lonnie Chisenhall's, in my opinion, he's their best prospect, including Santana. I would take Lonnie Chisenhall over Carlos Santana right now. I like the bat, the infielder, the athletic ability. I like everything about Lonnie Chisenhall. So, and I was wrong on him in the 2008 draft. Maybe I'm overreacting now, but I like it when teams step out of their box a little bit. I think that's what the Rockies did here, and I think it will really benefit them. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I do think the one mistake teams can make is to paint themselves into a corner.
Right.
Whether you're saying we prefer college players over high school players or high school players over college players, there's only, in any given draft, in general, there's going to be 20 to 30, you know, really good players, you know, who are, you know, longtime big leaguers to superstars. And then there's going to be about another 20 to 30 useful players, you know, who provide you some value. And if you shut off, you know, any aspect of the draft, whether it's high school or college, you're shutting off some of those players.
I agree.
They're going to be out there. And you know, getting back to the Rockies, they made no secret when they started off, and I think they did paint themselves into the corner this way. When they started, they figured, it's kind of funny when you think about it with Mike Hampton and Denny Nagel.
Yeah.
But when the Rockies started, their philosophy was, nobody's ever going to want to come pitch here. We're not going to be able to attract free agents, not realizing that people will go anywhere if you pay them top dollar.
Right.
But their philosophy was, we're going to draft pitching, because, you know, hitters will be, you know, dying to come here, but we won't be able to attract free agent pitchers. And when Bill Schmidt came in, was kind of when they had a new regime taking over and kind of got away from that philosophy. And then on the flip side, the Rockies, you know, have been for years very college-oriented this decade. They kind of flipped in the other direction. I think the teams that draft the best are the teams that are willing to take, you know, whoever they think the best players out there. And, you know, I don't think they're going to advance to the World Series now, but, you know, a lot of these players on the Dodgers right now were drafted by the Dodgers this decade after Logan White took over. And
right.
It's funny because there's this perception that Logan is a big high school, you know, guy, that he wants all high school players. And if you talk to Logan, that's not the case. He wants the best player on the board. And back at the beginning of the decade, when everybody was getting very college-heavy and Moneyball was all the rage, teams were, you know, drafting college players like never before. So the common sense would tell you that, you know, if you have your draft board set up and people are taking all the college players, that a lot of times the best players left when your pick comes up are going to be high school players. And if you go look at the Dodgers the last couple of years, you know, and Logan's now an assistant GM in charge of scouting. He's not the scouting director, but he's still heavily involved. You know, he's a little less heavily involved than he was before. They've drafted a lot of college players. So I think what you got to do, you know, I've said this many times, and talent's talent. You can't sit there and say, oh, we want college players, or oh, we want high school players, or oh, you know, we're going to take a college pitcher, you know, because we need a guy who'll get there quick. You have to take the best guy on the board. And I think, you know, that's a roundabout way to get back to, that's what the Rockies did this year. They took the best guys on the board.
I think they did as well. It's the Baseball America podcast. I'm John Manuel along with Jim Callis. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter. That's twitter.com/baseballamerica. You can also send us email questions at podcast@baseballamerica.com. Don't have any new ones in the podcast inbox right now, but you can feel free to send those along. Jim, let's talk about a couple other categories that come up in the draft report cards that are always interesting. I was fascinated by the fact that this year, I was really underwhelmed by the best power hitter category. The 2008 draft was such a good draft for hitters, and it was very easy to come up with five power hitters. I'm frankly underwhelmed by the best power hitters in this year's draft. I think it's especially telling that best power hitter, the only two college guys that made our top five were both available in the 2008 draft. And Chris Dominguez was a fifth-round pick who didn't sign, but the Rockies really didn't make a huge run at him after an initial those negotiations got to a bad start and just didn't go anywhere. And then Kit Mathis was not even drafted as a college junior. And that's kind of shocking. That guy actually, I'm pretty positive. I was just looking at some old The Perfect Game Rollwood Bat showcases this weekend. And we've got a couple guys going down there. And they were doing some Perfect Game Rollwood Bat showcase research. And I'm pretty sure Kent Mathis played on the Team Baseball America team back in 2004. So he was a guy in high school and was an athlete and all those kind of good things. And he wasn't even drafted in 2008. But him and Chris Dominguez, the only college guys who made the best power hitter category. I was really underwhelmed by that category in general. Just going through the draft report cards kind of reiterated to me how weak of a draft this was for hitting. There were very few clubs in the American League that really focused on hitters in this draft. And the ones that did, you know, they were able to kind of target some guys and get their guys because most of the other clubs seemed like they concluded this is not a great draft for hitters. We got some hitters last year. Let's load up on pitchers in this draft. Did you find that talking to scouting directors as well?
I did. I mean, I think that we were spoiled. You know, 2008 was probably one of the top two hitter drafts of the decade, along with 2005. I mean, with guys like, you know, Alvarez and Smoke and Brett Wallace and, you know, Yonder Alonso. You just had a lot of gifted hitters, and you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, Bortring, you know, and even the guys, you know, it's not like Bortring came out, and Bobby Bortring, who we ranked as a top power hitter, came out and tore up pro ball.
Right.
You know, in the Pioneer League. And, you know, Chris Dominguez, I mean, Chris Dominguez's raw power's off the charts. There's still, I just feel like I've talked about that guy for about
8 years.
In the COD League in the last 2 years of doing, you know, our Kentucky draft coverage. You know, last year he was a sophomore eligible draft pick. Rocky, you know, according to the Rockies, they said, will you sign for X? He said he would. And then they drafted him and he wouldn't. And that was that. But, I mean, the problem with Chris is, I mean, as huge as his raw power is, he still swings and misses a lot. So nobody's convinced, you know, 100% he's going to, you know, definitely make enough contact. And Mathis, I think, was just a guy who, you know, was acclaimed in high school. And he was an AFLAC, you know, All-American game performer and just didn't perform like people hoped at Alabama for 3 years. And then the light switched on. I mean, he kind of intrigues me. I'm actually surprised he lasted to the fourth round, to be honest with you, John, just from the standpoint of, it's not like this guy was a nobody. I mean, he was a guy in high school. He had a, you know, a tremendous year in college. You know, he led NCAA in home runs. He's a senior, so he's not going to cost you a ton. You know, you're going to get, you know, a little discount. And, you know, you're talking about a proven college hitter in a draft short on proven college hitters who's not going to give you any trouble about signing because he's a senior. And yet he lasted till the fourth round. That one surprises me a little bit in retrospect that he lasted that long.
I was shocked he lasted that long. I was really, really shocked he lasted that long. I didn't understand it. I'm a Kent Mathis guy. He's athletic, too. He's not a stiff. The guy can run. He can throw. I mean, that was another reason why when I was looking at the Rockies draft, the value of their first three picks, but I loved the fact they got Kent Mathis. I also really liked the fact that they got Joe Sanders at Auburn, where they got him. I like their sixth-round pick, Chris Balcom Miller, the JUCO pitcher they got out of California who had a tremendous debut in the Pioneer League. I like Wes Musick, where they got him in the ninth round, a guy who had, in my mind, it sounds like first five-round stuff, but he has some medical issues. I liked Avery Barnes in the 11th round. I like Charlie Ruiz in the 10th. I think they have a chance to have six, seven big leaguers out of that draft. A lot of things alike in the Rockies draft there. So another category, I guess the one thing that did stand out to me, Jim, was we had a much harder time limiting ourselves to five in best fastball. You know, obviously Steven Strasburg, you know, he won best fastball. He won best secondary pitch. Best athlete, we didn't have a whole lot of trouble there. One of the more interesting categories that we have to do is best late-round pick. And it's only in the last few years we've had to divvy that up, best late-round pick. Above slot bonus, best late round pick at or below slot bonus. Let's talk about that category a little bit. those top five above slot bonuses, those are some unique guys to me. And it is kind of the usual suspects. Orioles, you know, they're the surprise there. They had two of the top five. Red Sox and Yankees check in. I'm a little bit interested in talking about the Padres, because the Padres, I thought, had a good draft. After years of really, in my mind, the Padres drafting low ceiling, and we haven't always been fans of the Grady Fuson, Chief Gaten approach, the college guys, the pitchers who hit the mitt, you know, control pitchers like Wade LeBlanc over pitchers with stuff. Here's a guy in Jorge Reyes at Oregon State who kind of fits the bill, more of a raw power arm, even if he is a college guy. Maybe using Reyes as a jumping off point, talk about the Padres draft, which we ranked fourth. What do you think of San Diego's draft, and maybe Reyes in particular, who you covered obviously this year in the Cape?
I really like their draft too. We rated them the fourth best draft overall, and this gets back to what we were touching on earlier. You know, I think, you know, we talk about people, you know, painting themselves into a corner. I think the Padres over recent years probably had the smallest corner they painted themselves into. You know, they wanted a very, you know, narrow demographic, and it led to a bunch of lower ceiling players, which is what their system, you know, is filled with, you know, for the most part right now. And this year, they went in a total different direction. You know, they took a guy, you know, it's funny. I mean, the thing is that they were so college oriented that I remember when they took Matt Bush, number one overall in 2004, which, you know, was a series of poor decisions that led them to Matt Bush. I remember Chief Gaten in the press conference, like, saying, "We shocked the world today and took a high school player." He was serious, like that was a big thing. And this year they went very high school heavy. I mean, the first round they took the best athlete in the draft, one of the best draft athletes in recent memory, in Donovan Tate. But you know, he's a guy who, I mean, he's raw. I mean, he's not refined. Some guys wonder about the bat a little bit. Even the Padres say, you know, his swing was probably better as a sophomore than it was as a senior. You know, in the second round they came back with another high school athletic outfielder in Everett Williams. In the fourth round, they took a tremendous high school arm that's raw in Kevious Sampson, and they got all those guys done. You know, Donovan Tate cost them, you know, $6.25 million, which is the high school record. But with Everett Williams, Kevious Sampson, between them, they got those guys for about $1.375 million, I think. My numbers are right off the top of my head. And that was a little bit less than what people thought. And then getting back to Jorge Reyes, I think he's a chance to be one of the tremendous picks in the draft. Here's a guy who, as you all know, John, I mean, was College World Series MVP as a freshman, terrible as a sophomore, inconsistent as a junior. Nobody really knew what to make of him. Potter's take him the 17th round. He's a Scott Boras client. He goes up to the Cape, which, you know, admittedly was not the strongest the Cape has ever been this summer. He looked great. He was 91-94 with a really good slider, much more consistent over the short number of starts he made up there. And then the end of the day, they signed him for $200,000 at the deadline, which is, you know, $50,000 over slot for a pick after the fifth round. But, I mean, to get Jorge Reyes for $200,000 based on what he showed on the Cape, I mean, I remember talking to a scouting director up there who had his area guys told him, don't worry about Reyes. You know, don't go see him in the spring because he wasn't good enough.
Right.
And the scouting director told his area scouts, cross-checker, I better see, you know, I mean, granted, it wasn't necessarily the same Jorge Reyes going out there every weekend in the spring. But the scouting director told his guys, he's like, I need to see guys like this in the spring. I don't need to be told not to see guys like this.
That's right.
So I think he could be a real steal. And he is an above-slot bonus. We list him, you know, fifth on that list. But, I mean, for $200,000, it wasn't like they gave, you know, $990,000 to Cameron Coffey like the Orioles did to a high school kid coming off of Tommy John surgery, or the Red Sox giving $750,000 to Brandon Jacobs, who was more of a football player in high school. He was above slot, but it was a very reasonable sign.
That's what I like best about it. He's a college guy with some track record, and the risk is lower. So I like their draft. I thought Kevious Sampson in the fourth round, tremendous value there. A high school pitcher with arm strength. I mean, when is the last time the Padres drafted one of those? I can't think of one.
Back and they got James Needy, who is a 6'6", 195-pound projectable high school kid. I mean, they don't usually draft guys like that. They usually draft their third-round pick was Jerry Sullivan. Even he, I think, breaks the mold a little bit. I mean, he's got plus stuff, and he put up some nice numbers in college, but it was in the Summit League. I mean, so it's not like those numbers mean a ton. I mean, Oral Roberts dominates that league every year. But, you know, they went out, and this year it seemed like they went out and got, you know, athletes and projectable guys, which I think in a way doesn't necessarily bode, you know, there's a lot of rumors that there's going to be a lot of changes in that front office once a new GM is brought in. And the fact that the scouting department drafted with a totally different philosophy this year makes you think that they realize they need to do something differently. So I think we may see some changes there once the Potters name a new GM.
Yeah, I agree. And I just think I think their last draft might be the best one of that group. It's really kind of
it's
interesting.
Funny how that happened. I mean, that happened with David Lakey in Houston with the
right.
Astros, and it happened. You know, when Greg Smith got fired in Detroit or reassigned to Detroit, now he's with Pittsburgh, his last first-round pick was Justin Verlander, who's, you know, and they got Joel Zamaya in the 11th round of that draft.
It really is amazing how that happens over and over again. I think the owners are reading Baseball America, and if they were reading, they'd say, hey, we think they had a great draft this time. Like, you know, last year we ranked the Padres farm system 29th. I think we were probably light on their farm system. They had a really good year as a farm system. I think we were underwhelmed by their lack of athleticism. We were underwhelmed by Alan Dykstra in the first round last year. There wasn't a lot of positive buzz when we ranked them last year. But you know what? Their college guys went out and performed this year. I don't think they have a top 10 farm system, maybe not even a top 15. We probably should have had them in that 15 to 25 range more than 29. But, you know, it's a better farm system than we accounted for. But now you see Jeff Morad. I think he really just wanted his own guy. But one of the things he pointed to was player development. And I actually do think that over the long haul, the Padres haven't done a great job in player development. And mostly I think that Kevin Towers made a lot of chicken salad out of something else. But, I just think it's funny. Like you said, I think they were just getting the hang of they were fine-tuning their approach and getting better with their approach. And now they're probably not – they may not keep their jobs with a new owner and new general manager. I really think that's kind of ironic.
I'd say rather fine-tuned. I would go beyond that and say change drastically. But
I think last year's draft was their usual approach. They just drafted better players. I think Jeff Decker's a better version of the kind of player they usually draft. I know
he's kind of the same type of guy. But
James Darnell's a good athlete for a college player.
100% bad. He's like a very good hitter.
But he's a better version of that. He's
not the same guy, but I was going to say, too, I mean, I think the thing is, too, we're talking about guys, you know, a lot of times when guys, you know, wind up getting reassigned as scouting director, they wind up, we look back and say that was their best draft. I think it just goes to show you how hard it is to judge these drafts. Cause,
great point.
Speaking of Kevin Towers, I'm not sure if I ever bought this completely, but when he was hired as GM, Larry Lucchino was with the Padres and hired Kevin Towers as GM. And Lucchino always likes to have, you know, a new guy. He kind of cultivates and mentors like he did with Theo Epstein in Boston. And he said at the press conference that they looked at a bunch of candidates and couldn't find the right fit. And there's a direct quote from Larry Lucchino. They read Baseball America, and we just rated the Padres as having the best draft in baseball. And he thought, well, maybe Kevin Towers should get a look for this job. We did rank the Padres as having the best draft in 1995. If you go back and you look at that draft, I'm looking at it right now, the best player they got was the second pick in the draft, Ben Davis, who wasn't very good at all. And the only other big leaguers they got out of the draft were guys like Gabe Alvarez, Brandon Cole, and Kevin Walker. I mean, it's just a really nondescript draft in retrospect when you look at it. But at the time, we thought it was the best draft, and if Larry Lucchino was telling the truth, we helped Kevin Towers get the GM job in the first place.
You're welcome, Kevin. That's funny. Because that draft...
I guess a 13-year run, if I'm doing my math correctly.
Yeah, he did. That is funny, because I just remember how much... I started here in September 96. I remember how many times I had to pull photos of Ben Davis. Boy, we loved some Ben Davis back in the day.
He was the number two pick in the draft. I mean...
Yeah, they passed on Kerry Wood. We kept writing about how they passed on Kerry Wood to take Ben Davis.
Yeah, although, again, you had some people who thought Kerry Wood was... You know, that was... The great thing I remember about Kerry Wood being drafted that year is he pitched, I don't know if it was both ends of a doubleheader or
games
on back-to-back days in high school, but his high school coach had him throw about 250 pitches in a 24 or 36-hour period, and Al Goldis about had a heart attack. But, you know, it's funny, you know, all sidetracks for some. Looking back at this draft, you know, your first pick was Darren Erstad, who, you know, was... You know, had a solid career, but he, you know, wasn't a superstar. Ben Davis was Fizzle's second pick. Jose Cruz had a decent career, but wasn't what he was supposed to be as a third pick. I mean,
right.
Can't argue with Kerry Wood. But do you remember who the fifth pick was in that draft?
I'm looking right at it. I did remember that it was Ariel Prieto.
Yeah, who was like this big sensation. He was terrible. Your sixth pick was the best hitter, high school hitter in the draft, Jamie Jones of the Marlins. Never played in the big leagues. And the one thing I guess I probably remember most of all about this draft is back then, I was our college baseball writer. I was in Omaha. We used to do this this big press conference with our player of the year, and we'd bring the All-Americans who were in Omaha into this press conference out in Omaha, and we would pipe in the first round of the draft via MLB's conference call. They'd allow us to pump that in if the draft wasn't anywhere near what it was today being on TV. So Todd Helton, who was our player of the year, was there when that's how he found out when the Rockies called out his name. And I will never forget Todd Helton's just smile. He smiled like the whole day. He was so happy the Rockies, you know, that's your dream as a hitter, obviously, get drafted by the Rockies. How thrilled he was that the Rockies had taken him. And that's probably my biggest memory of that day, was Todd Helton just being elated that the Rockies had taken him. Even though he was at the eighth pick, he didn't go, there's seven guys taken ahead of him. He probably couldn't have been happier if he was number one because he was going to go hit in Coors Field.
Todd Helton or Roy Halladay, best career of that year's draft? Who would you take?
I think if you put him in neutral parks, I might take Roy Halladay, but I do think Todd Helton might wind up being a Hall of Famer when all is said and done. Halladay, probably has more work to do than Todd Helton to finish that path to Cooperstown. Boy, looking at this, we could probably talk for hours about this draft. I mean, this talk about another end of spring. You have Ryan Jaroncic, the Mets took with the pick right behind Roy Halladay.
Oh, I missed that.
Who retired a year later, took his bonus money, went to college.
He didn't go to college. He went to California Junior College to play football. I mean, that guy was never serious about playing baseball. That's a good story.
That was just a disaster. You have Alvy Shepard, who was Darren Erstad's teammate in Nebraska, who had an ERA of about 6. He was, and had predictable results. You had with back-to-back picks, Chad Hutchinson, the Braves took, didn't sign him. He went to Stanford and wound up having a star-crossed career in 2 sports. And right behind him, the Yankees took the University of Texas's quarterback in Shea Morant. So it's some crazy guys all over the place in that draft.
That was, and then you go to the second round, and you have a couple of useful pitchers. Brett Tomko in that round, Jared Washburn, a couple guys who had very long big league careers. And I would say those are productive draft picks. And Tomko was the first pick for the Reds that year. You had Mark Bellhorn that next year. And then one of the best players in this draft, you could argue him as the best player in this draft. I'm sure that his agent would, Carlos Beltran. I mean, Carlos Beltran was a second-round pick of the Royals that year. You could argue him from the position scarcity, being a center fielder. I would take Helton's career over Carlos Beltran's career, but that's arguable for sure.
I'd probably take Beltran because of the position scarcity. But you're right, Beltran, the interesting thing about that one is he is far and away the best pick, and I guess Javier Vasquez might be the second best pick out of Puerto Rico since Puerto Rico went into the draft.
Yeah, no doubt, far and away the best Puerto Rican draft pick. It's the Baseball America podcast with John and Jim. Jean et Jim. We
transported back to 1995 unintentionally.
We probably should wrap up real quick. But a couple odds and ends that came up, Jim, I wanted to mention. Most intriguing background is always a real fun one. But we like to we have different ideas of what's intrigue. Well, we have different things intrigue the two of us, which is funny. But I think we had a slam dunk most intriguing background non-baseball category this year with Wande Olabasi, the Padres outfielder. Why don't you explain a little bit about Wande Olabasi?
A tool standpoint, he's got plus speed, he's got huge raw power, he's extremely raw to the point where he barely played 3 years at Stanford, but from the intriguing background standpoint, he was born to a royal family in Nigeria. I believe he's a Nigerian prince.
I believe that's
right. Later moved to Saudi Arabia, which he represented in the 2000 Little League World Series, and also is a biomechanical engineering major at Stanford. In all the years of doing most intriguing backgrounds, I don't think we've ever had that combination before.
No, that's a pretty good combination. On the other end of the scale, I like the fact that the Phillies' top pick, Kelly Dugan, that his dad's an actor, director who works with, whose last two big credits are that he directed Adam Sandler in You Don't Mess With the Zohan and Chuck and Larry. I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry. So slightly less regal background for Kelly Dugan. But I think people are more familiar with Kelly Dugan's dad maybe than they are with the Prince of Nigeria. And then a lot of interesting baseball relatives. Mike Yastrzemski, Jake Porcello, I think, is interesting. Harold Baines Jr. And a couple others, I think, that are notable. But
I want to throw two more of my favorites. Though,
go ahead.
I think you like the baseball relatives more than I do, and I like the non-baseball relatives more, but you got Virgil Hill, who's a sixth-round pick of the Cardinals. He's a guy who can really run. His mother, Deneen Howard Hill, won a silver medal in the 88 Olympics in the relays.
I love Virgil Hill. I love the Virgil Hill background. I argued for it last year. I think you like your background, guys, more than you like mine. That's the point.
That's probably true. And his father, Virgil Sr., won a silver medal in the Olympics in boxing and later held some light heavyweight and cruiserweight championships. And then my other background I really liked was Wes Luquette, an unsigned catcher.
That's a good one. I like that one.
He's at LSU. He's the grandson of the Tabasco tycoon Paul McElhaney. And he's also a star quarterback at the Isidore Newman School, which is where Peyton and Eli Manning were star quarterbacks. So.
See, that one doesn't get me as much, what high school they went to, but the Tabasco fortune is awesome. I love the Tabasco fortune.
Slash Manning high school quarterback, so.
I'll throw in that Trace Thompson is the son of Michael Thompson, who of course was a sixth man on a couple of Lakers world championship teams in the NBA, and I think he's got a brother and a sister playing college basketball. I think it tells you that this kid, not just an athlete who plays baseball, he's an athlete who loves baseball. He had an NBA dad and two siblings playing college basketball. He probably was encouraged, had every opportunity to play basketball, but this guy wants to play baseball. He's one of the reasons I thought the White Sox had a potentially really, really good draft. Jared Mitchell, Trace Thompson, a couple premium athletes. That said, I think the White Sox aren't going to top last year's draft with Gordon Beckham at the number 8 slot for a long time. It'll be hard for them to top that one. So, great podcast.
Trace Thompson was a nice get for them too, John, because he was a guy who's supposed to be somewhat difficult to sign. He was going to UCLA, which a lot of times keeps its players.
Right.
And the White Sox, not that they went crazy, but the White Sox almost never go over slot, and they went over slot to sign him. Their slot was around $596,000. And the White Sox, for them, made the big step of going $29,000 over slot to sign him as a mid-second-round pick.
If they had signed,
I don't know why the $29,000 made a difference, but apparently it did.
If they'd signed Brian Morgado, I would have been I would have pushed for their draft to be in the top five. I didn't necessarily think they got a pitcher that I really truly get on board with to put them in the top five. Doesn't mean that they won't, but because Kyle Bellamy will probably move quickly to the big leagues. I do like David Holmberg. How that was a good draft for them. Ryan Buick has a chance, or Buck, whatever, however you pronounce his last name. He's got a shot too.
Mock draft picks.
Was he really?
He was my 8th round pick, I think. Yes.
Well, you took him in the same round as Doug Lauman, so.
Or maybe 7th round, because I think I picked behind the White Sox.
So. Oh, then you probably took him in the 7th round.
You're right with Morgado. I mean, there's another guy in the Cape who is kind of like Jorge Reyes.
Right.
Had a very inconsistent spring as a draft-eligible sophomore in Tennessee. I mean, he's over it, but he has Tommy John in his background. He hasn't had as much success as Reyes. But as a power arm lefty, he went in the 3rd round and was really, really good on the Cape. And the White Sox, at that point, we forget, over the summer, before the deadline, they traded for J.D. Peavy.
Right.
And they picked up Alexis Rios' contract, so there went all their extra money. And they would not – I think Morgado was signed for – he wasn't going to sign for slot, but I think they could have signed Morgado for $500,000.
I don't think they could have gotten –
and they weren't willing to go over slot to get him, and that may be one they regret next
year.
Morgado pitches like he did on the Cape. He's going to be a first-round pick.
They were willing to go over slot, just not, I think, as far as Morgado, but then they wanted them to go. But I think you hit on the big reason. When you're an organization, in my mind, that's drained some of your – I mean, they traded Dexter Carter. They traded Aaron Pareda. They traded Clayton Richardson. They traded some of their top pitching prospects. Not that Dexter Carter's any great shakes, but he was having a good year in low A. Outside of Daniel Hudson, I can't think of – who made the big leagues. I can't think of an impact arm in their system. I thought, especially after trading Pareda and Clayton Richard, they needed an impact left-handed pitcher, and they didn't really get a power lefty arm in this draft class, and I thought Morgado fit their needs, would have been a guy I would have stepped out on. But, I don't know what those negotiations were like. I know something about it, but I wasn't there. I don't know what their budget is, so hard to criticize. Just if they'd gotten Morgado, they would have been in my top five for sure. So,
dude, I think if they got him, too, if they had wanted to, this is a team that their bullpen was kind of really, really shaky this year.
They could have pushed
him. If you wanted to move him as a reliever, he could have gotten to the big leagues very quick. I mean, you and I may disagree on this. I'm not convinced that Brian Morgado is not going to be better than Aaron Pareda. I'm not saying he will, because I don't think he needs to show more consistency.
He's similar.
Morgado's got a more well-rounded repertoire, And I think he has a chance to be a better pitcher than Aaron Pareto, who was their first-round pick a couple years ago, who they included in the Jake Peavy trade. And
I'll disagree because of the usual disagreement that you and I have. I value fastball command much more than you do. Morgado's never shown command or feel for a fastball. It doesn't mean that he can't throw it hard, but he does not have feel for the pitch. Pareto has, can add and subtract off the fastball a little bit, and I think that mitigates a bit his inability to spin a breaking ball or his secondary stuff, but that's a philosophical discussion for another podcast.
I'm just saying they're comparable.
They're very comparable. I agree.
It'll be interesting to see, because if Morgado, and again, he hasn't done it on a consistent basis, if he does put things together, especially, you know, we've talked about, you know, I think Matt on the podcast, about how next year's draft class, especially on the college side, is very uninspiring.
Absolutely.
If Morgado pitches like he did on the Cape, he's going to go in the first 15 picks next year's draft.
I don't think there's any doubt that guys who were ones who got away in this draft report cards, like LaVon Washington, like Jake Iliopoulos, like Brian Morgado, those guys, and James Paxton, those guys are going to be significant factors in the 2010 draft. There's no doubt about that. There's a lot of those guys who got away in this year's draft who will be factors again next year. So we're over the 40-minute mark. Going to have to wrap it up, Jim. But we could do next time we'll talk about the 1996 draft. On the next Baseball
America podcast. John, you're, the ones who got away you just mentioned, I think that the ones who got away usually have more of an impact 3 years down the line because it's the high school guys who are the better players usually because most of your college players do sign. But I think that this year's group of the ones who got away will have more impact on the following year's draft than anyone I can remember.
I think you're right, though.
LaVon Washington, like you just mentioned, I think he's a potential first-round pick. Iliopoulos is a potential first-round pick. And lefties, Paxton, James Paxton, Brian Morgado are two potential first-round picks. Sam Dyson, who went back to South Carolina.
Yeah, Sam Dyson.
He's a potential first-round
pick. I forgot about Sam Dyson.
So, I mean, there's five potential. I mean, the odds are that they all aren't going to go that high. But there's five guys who could have been signed this year who are going to be in next year's draft who could be first-round picks.
That's
highly unusual.
I will honestly be shocked if all five of those guys are not first-round picks because the college class next year is brutal. I'm sorry, it's brutal. And if those guys – I'll be stunned if all five of those guys aren't first-round picks. I know not a lot can happen between now and June, but those guys are first-rounders for me for next year. But if anyone listening to this podcast who's ever been on the phone with Jim will understand how hard it is to get off the phone with Jim when you're engaged in the conversation, and it's the same thing with this podcast. We could definitely go on for a long time. It's a lot of fun, Jim. Thanks for calling in from Winnetka. We appreciate it.
It was a quick 40 minutes, and I'm pleased that the golden retriever puppy in the background only barked early in the podcast.
Me too. So for Jim Callis, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you next time on the Baseball America podcast. Until then, so long, everybody.